While visiting Kitale, a rural town of about 50,000 people in northeast Kenya, Kathy spent a night in Marge Humphrey's room, who was away at the time. I guess sleeping in someone's bed is a little like walking in their shoes, but Kathy didn't get a feel for who Marge Humphrey was until they met a few days later in the coastal city of Mombasa. A general thumbnail sketch would tell you that Marge grew up in Idaho, began working at the Catholic Worker in New York City in 1978, was greatly influenced there by a friend, Sister Mercy Hirschbeck, the Mary Knoll sister's first doctor, and became a physician's assistant herself in 1986. In 87, she joined the Mary Knoll Lay Mission Program and served in camps for displaced persons in war-torn southern Sudan from 1994 to 1996. Marge went home to the U.S. for 3 years, but in 2000, she returned to Africa and began working with the Missionary Sisters of Mary from Ireland at the Kitale AIDS Clinic in Kenya. That tells you a lot of the what. For the who and the why, just listen as Kathy talks with Marge Humphrey.
Kitale is beautiful, spectacular, and it's that spectacular beauty stands in contrast with the poverty and the AIDS problem and all the problems you look at. What is it like for you? What is your day's work like up there?
Well, I work in what's called the Kitale AIDS Program, which is a primary care clinic for people who are HIV positive or have full-blown AIDS. It was started by the Medical Missionaries of Mary Sisters from Ireland. And they had started out 11 or 12 years ago just trying to do some AIDS education in a time when nobody even wanted to hear the word AIDS, and slowly got some education things going and then started a small one-room primary care clinic to try to help people with nutrition and to stay healthy for as long as they could with some basic antibiotics, treat opportunistic infections. Really just hoping for people who really have this terrible disease to give them a chance to live a little bit longer. And I've always been very humbled by Kenyan people as we know them when they come into the clinic, because people aren't asking us to cure them. They accept what they have, but what they really, really want is to live long enough for their children to be a little bit older, to be able to be on their own. And they just say, please, 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 can you help me live long enough until the children are a little bit more grown? And, you know, that's what we tried to do. You know, at that time, we didn't have antiretrovirals. There wasn't even any talk of it. I came to the Kitale AIDS Program in 2000, and we started out doing home care. People who were too sick to even come into the clinic, we would go out and sometimes 20 minutes, half hour, even sometimes an hour's drive out into the bush into some pretty remote places, you know, where there were people dying at home with very little food, and just trying to support them, you know, in any way we could, and also to try to treat the infections that they had and to help the families deal with the fear that they had, because there are so many myths about this disease and what's true and what's not true, and can I catch this, you know, by basically bedside care. I spent more of my time in the homes with people and their families, and you really get to see what life is really like for them and for the whole family. And I think when you know a patient's whole family, it just makes a huge difference.
Marge, at the beginning of this disease, we all knew just enough to be terrified, and you said yourself, they really don't want to know. So how did you ever pull them in for the education to talk to them?
Well, it was really Sisters Mary and Teresa encouraging people with a non-judgmental approach, because one of the big things here is what people here call the stigma. People are terrified that if anybody knows, you know, people in their family, they'll throw them out, and that does happen, or that the neighbors will know, and it's terribly, terribly shameful for them. So they don't want people to know. And sometimes you find that if you do tell people in the family, first of all, we knew that a lot of the family members already knew. And they would say to us, you know he has AIDS, but don't tell him, it would devastate him. You know, and then in the privacy at his bedside, he would say, I know I have AIDS, but don't tell them that, you know. And we knew, all members of the family knew. And so it's just communication, family communication, and how they can help and support one another.
I can understand not wanting to hear that. I've wondered many times, okay, if it was me, if I was young and dating and facing all this, would I take myself in for a test? Would I want to know more? Would I want to know how to prevent? And a lot of us have a tendency to say, I don't want to know. So how do you get them? How do you talk to them?
Well, we tried to encourage people to get tested, because even people who are healthy, because you can live with this disease and be very healthy for many years before you finally start developing AIDS itself. And the sooner you know, and we start working on primary care for you, ways to stay healthy, those people do live longer. Mm-hmm. And knowing your status early, that's what they call it here, knowing your status, is very, very important for your health and also for your family, for your spouse, for your friends.
Yeah. What are some of the myths standing in the way, and how do you act as a myth buster?
Well, first, I want to say something about myth itself. I very often think of something that Father John Conway said to me years ago when we were first trying to deal with the disease and its impact here. And change in lifestyles has been very slow. And a lot of the attempts to teach about AIDS, of course, we can teach only in the way we know, which is a Western approach, you know, a scientific approach to the disease. And he said to me one day, I don't think we've yet penetrated the mythology of this culture, because essentially what we're telling people is that which is the primary value in this culture, which is procreation, that the act of procreation, what is to them immortality, it's your children and your children's children, that what to them has been life-giving in their culture is now an instrument of death. And that's an incredible thing to deal with and to face, and to find ways that do make sense within their culture. And it's a challenge, it still is, because you get people with all different levels of understanding, from, you know, more educated Kenyans to people out in the rural areas who have very little or no education.
By going up to Kitale, I was privileged to see the houses, the kind of houses that you might visit, the kind of families that you might visit. When you did home care, what was it you took in? What did you see?
Most of the people that we were caring for were very, very poor people. They had pretty modest huts, and here were people literally dying of a very miserable disease, laying on a piece of plastic on a dirt floor, you know, and not a lot of food, not a lot of options for diet, which, you know, when you're sick, some things you can eat and some things you can't, but very little choices in food. And so often, little children taking care of their parents, little children, and you see in many ways how adult they had become, you know, and you'd see there is not much childhood here as we know it. I mean, I've seen little children 6, 7 years old, you know, cleaning up the mother's bed sheets after she's had uncontrollable diarrhea, and very uncomplaining. The thing that just astounds us almost every time you go into a home is just people just light up, beautiful smile, and they really, really want to welcome you.
Marge sees some successes, some victories, and those help her survive when the people she's caring for don't.
You're doing so much good, but as rewarding as it is, it's got to haunt you. You take home this stuff every night with you.
I think every day is a mix, you know, of just incredible, incredible sorrow. And the hope, or the inspiration, I guess, that they give me with the courage that people have in facing this disease. And I remember one day we had a woman that we'd known for a couple of years. She'd been coming to the clinic, but we could see she was slowly going down, 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 and getting weaker and sicker. And we knew she probably wouldn't last too much longer. And her name was Esther, and she had a lovely little girl named Sheila, who was about 9 years old, who always came with her to the clinic and really helped her mother, and especially as her mother got weaker. And one day she came to the clinic, and she was so sick and so weak, and there really wasn't anything more medically that I had to offer her that was going to pick her up even for a time, you know, just make her more comfortable. And since she's one of the people that we had known, we've known the family for a long time, you know, after she left, Sister Mary and I, you know, said, well, we probably won't, you know, see Esther again. And then 2 weeks later, I was working in the clinic one day, and I was with a patient, and I looked out the window, and I saw a woman crawling on the ground toward the door of the clinic. I thought, oh my gosh, who's that? So I stopped, and Mary and I went out, and it was Esther. She had hired a bicycle. She had ridden for miles on the back of a bicycle to get to the clinic, and she was so sick and so weak, she couldn't even walk. So we went out and we carried her the rest of the way in and put her on a bed. And of course, the first thing was, you know, I said, Esther, how are you? And beautiful smile, you know, fine. She still had hope. You know, she said, my children, what's going to happen to my children? And we were finished. We helped her outside and got the fellow with the bicycle to take her home. And we walked back in the clinic, shut the door, and we both just started crying. I mean, you know, we just broke down. And because we see a lot of this every day, you know, we're able to kind of keep each other going. But, you know, and there's some days you just, yeah. And in fact, we didn't see her again. A few days later, little Sheila came in just sobbing and told us that her mother had died. She grabbed onto Sister Mary and just sobbed and sobbed, you know, this little girl.
Eleanor Ostrinsky continues our talk with Marge Humphrey.
The United States and promising, for example, all this money for AIDS, some of it is coming here, some of it is not coming here, not as much has been allocated. What are some of the things that, as someone that lives in Kenya, from the Kenyan perspective, how do you view the United States in relation to AIDS funding?
Well, I think obviously we've waited a long, long time for, you know, hoping that there would be more response from the developed countries and from the United States. I just got a letter from a friend of mine. I had told her about our sponsorship program, and she said, oh, my husband and I would like to do that. And she said, you know, I think it's so sad that you have to beg for this money, you know, to get these drugs for people when, you know, we just have so much in the United States. And it's really not much of a question for anybody in the United States who has AIDS to be on these drugs. She herself works in a clinic that cares for a lot of AIDS patients. But we have heard for the last several years that money would be coming. And then we've heard some of the discouraging arguments why it shouldn't come. For example, some of the things that people have read in the popular press or media, some of the people saying, well, they would never work in Africa because, you know, these drugs, they have to be taken on time. You have to take the correct number of pills at the same time each day. And how could Africans do this? They don't have watches. You know, and I mean, this is just such an incredible, incredible misunderstanding that people that we have on antiretrovirals, they are so responsible with them and so careful about what they're doing. Recently, I talked to a South African pediatrician who was telling me the same thing, you know. He said, I just can't believe some of the arguments that I'm hearing that people in Africa would never be able to do this, you know. He said, I have never had more motivated mothers in my life. You know, and I spent some time with him in his clinic, and it was just incredible to see women who don't have any formal education never miss an appointment, come with their pills, count them out, tell you exactly, you know, when their child took it. And he said, I wish people could see this. He said, I just have never seen more motivated people in my life. And that's certainly been our experience at the Kitali AIDS program the last few months and the people that we have started on the antiretrovirals.
So what are you hoping that the United States would do or change in order to make drugs more available here in Kenya?
Well, I certainly hope that people do understand not only how badly needed they are, but that we have the infrastructure here and the motivation for people to give them new life, new hope. And as we've come closer to this in the last year, talking with various donor organizations, you know, trying to get these drugs, is a lot of them are donor driven. And that is that people in the United States then want to tell us how to run our clinic, you know, and with good intention. There are very few people who say, you've been doing this for a number of years, and we trust that you know how to do this. You know how to make it work in your community with the particular people with whom you live and work, you know, that you understand how to do it, I guess. So I think that's been a challenge, you know, because understandably also, you know, people who are donating things, you know, do want to assure that, you know, the drugs are being used right, that they get into the right hands, that there's not and abuse, but also to understand that here, you know, we don't have computer databases for all the statistics and whatever that people want, and we can do the best we can with those kind of things. But I guess I would hope there would be more discussion on how we can cooperate and do good programs here in Africa, you know, instead of having them entirely donor-driven. And there are some people that are doing that, that have approached, you know, and say, how do you run your clinic? How do you see that this can work in this situation? And it'd be nice if there were more of those.
No, that's for sure. I think community-based healthcare is probably the way to go everywhere, not just in Kenya. And there's a lot of money with strings attached. So, is there anything else that you'd like to say that we didn't cover, or an experience that you'd like to tell other people?
Well, only I guess one more patient story, and that is a young woman who we were caring for who was getting sicker and sicker. And finally, by last November, the last couple times we saw her, she was so sick. She was about 20 years old, and her mother would carry her into the clinic. She couldn't walk. And then we just didn't see her again. We were certain that she had died. There's a lot of people, you know, once they die, the families live far, far away. And we don't always know, you know, what's happened. But she really was on death's door, so we were certain that she died. And 6 months later, I was in the clinic, and Wairimu, one of the Kenyan nurses, came to me and said, "See that woman sitting out there on the bench? Do you know her?" And I looked, and I said, "No, it's nobody I know." And she said, "Yes, you do." And I said, "No, I don't." She said, "Yes, you do. Take a good look." I took a good look, and I said, "No, I don't think it's anybody I know." She said, "That's Liz." I said, "What?" She said, "That's Liz." And this was a beautiful, healthy-looking young woman. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I just went out, and we just hugged each other. And I said, "Liz, what happened to you?" I didn't want to tell her we thought you died, you know. But she said, in November, she had a cousin who got a job in one of the big hospitals. And he came and took her from the family home to the hospital because they had just gotten antiretrovirals, and they were starting a program. And he got her into the program on antiretrovirals, and this is a completely, completely new person who looks just so healthy, and she's so happy and strong. And I mean, she really was a living skeleton when we last saw her. So I guess not to focus so much on antiretrovirals, but it's so new to us, and to see the effects, and it's given us so much new hope that I guess anybody in the U.S. can do to help advocate for these drugs for Africa, it would just be wonderful.
As a group of teens from a local church choir practiced outside, Marge spoke with Eleanor and Kathy about the many connections between Americans and the people of Kenya, and how clear that became when the U.S. Embassy was bombed in Nairobi.
It was interesting when the U.S. Embassy was bombed in 1998. I was actually in the U.S. at the time, and I came home from 97 to 2000. I was in the States, and I was teaching at the time on the day that that happened, and I didn't know about it until I got to work and heard it on the news. And of course, I was very upset. I mean, it's in Nairobi. I know a lot of people in Nairobi, and the stories were horrible, you know, about hundreds of people killed and injured, and of course, not knowing if anybody I knew was in the vicinity. And it was very upsetting. And I know a friend of mine there said to me, you know, she said, I feel so bad for you. I know you're really, really upset, you know. She said, but it's hard for me to feel anything because I don't feel any connection, I mean, to people in Kenya. I mean, what's my relationship to them? I don't have anything to relate to, you know. I said, you don't have anything to relate to. I said, look at that cup of coffee in your hand, the cotton of the clothes on your back, you know, the fruit that you get in the stores. All these things that we enjoy without even thinking about it are off the sweat of their labor, you know, and we don't give it a second thought. we're connected to them in so many more ways than people would know. I mean, the whole thing with globalization and where we get all of our products and a lot of the things that, you know, we particularly enjoy, the labor and the hard work of others, and that labor is very, very poorly paid. They don't get much for it, you know, and I don't think a lot of people really realize that, you know. And also, as we see our world getting smaller and smaller and smaller, I mean, we are all related. We're all, you know, we are all brothers and sisters. And I was very, very touched by Kenyan people's response to me on September 11th. People on the streets of Kitale, a small agricultural town in Kenya, they knew that it was such a horrible thing, and I was suffering, and so many Kenyans came to me and gave me what they call here giving pole, you know, giving sympathy, saying, I'm so sorry, you know, and they see it, they see how connected we are, you know, but I don't think sometimes we always see that.
Thank you, Marge Humphrey.